Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Welcome again to another episode of the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. And I'm very happy with the guest of today, who has a very interesting profile that caught our eyes. It's Mark Barrett-Downer. He is head of commodities risk management at Friesland Campina, a big dairy company in the Netherlands. And what I found very interesting about his profile was that he started in Goldman Sachs. He worked for a couple of years as a floor trader in Chicago Board of Trade. I have had some very interesting experiences there as well. And now, yeah, he is head of commodities risk management at Friesland Campina, which covers a lot dairy industry, which is an industry which is also important for Vesper, but we also want to know more about. So welcome. I'm very happy with you and interested to hear your war stories.
Yeah, Mark, welcome, man. We've, of course, worked together, but now here in the podcast, working for a global dairy company. I think with your background into this traditional world, interested to see how your life evolves into this world from this investment banking and now into this world of food, basically, as well, in combination with finance. So welcome. Welcome to this.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, both, for having me. I think it's quite nice, and I feel honored that you guys asked me to come and tell my stories. Yeah, I'm really glad and excited to have this chat with you guys today.
Tell us a bit about Mark, because I think the listeners would love to hear a bit of Goldman. How did you end up into this world? What's a bit your story?
I was born and raised in a small town in the beautiful Dolomites in Italy. Already at a young age, I developed a very strong passion for skiing, which has been also a little bit my leitmotif throughout my career for different career choices I made. I skied through high school. I tried to ski professionally also. Then when I was 18, I had a really bad accident while ski racing. Ended up in a coma for 2 days. So that was quite a life-changing event for me. And then that made me think a little bit about what choices are you going to make with your life. And then at that point, I made the decision to move to the United States. They have a great system with the universities where basically they have sports teams that allow, so to say, athletes to become student athletes, and they also help you financially to pay the tuition because of your kind of sports talent. And so I ended up doing that. I ended up in Salt Lake City, where I graduated with a finance degree. After that, I started working at Goldman. So that was basically my first experience in my professional career. If we go back a little bit, I always wanted or had a passion for markets and trading. This already started in high school, I remember. Probably started for all the wrong reasons. Maybe we can delve into it a little bit later. But so I always, in the back of my mind, there was always, I want to become a trader. And thanks to skiing, I met this guy who used to own a home in Park City, which is close to Salt Lake City, where I studied, a very successful local trader, as we would call him. And interesting enough, he was very interested in skiing. Yes. So, so it was good because we had the same interest. So we became friends, so to say. And he was also a friend at that time of my coach. And he was a local in the corn pit. He was a Backman spreader, basically trading Backman spreads. Yeah, and I just kept bugging him about, hey, I would love to do what you're doing. And then back and forth throughout my college career. And then oddly enough, before I graduated, actually 2 semesters before I graduated, Goldman was on campus doing interviews. And everybody at that time wanted to work for Goldman, and everybody signed up for this interview. So I said, you know what, I'm just going to also sign up. Probably they're not going to take me because, you know, they have a 0.5% recruitment rate or whatever it is. But then oddly enough, a couple of weeks after, I received an offer from them, and it was 6-7 months before I was graduating. So I was like, it would be really nice now to accept the offer. And then I also talked with the guy, with the local in Chicago, and he said, just do it, right? At least get some experience in, because I'm telling you. And he was very upfront with me. This business of trading is not as you think it is, or as people imagine it is from the movies and stuff.
Not even the old days.
I think it's a very tough business. It's a grind. It's hard on you, especially in the beginning, right? So he said, just try to go and work for Goldman, see how it is. And then if you do not like it, then you can come out to Chicago. And then that basically what I ended up doing. I actually didn't mind working there, but it wasn't really what I wanted there to have, so to say, more corporate job. So then I decided to go to Chicago. Ended up on the trading floor. I clerked for him and another of his partners for a month or two, basically just being a clerk, punching trades, keeping positions for them. And then 2 months after, they gave me a handheld device and some trading cards. And they said, now it's your turn. And it was quite funny because I remember I was like, are you not going to teach me how I'm supposed to do here? And I said, hey, Mark, I'm sorry. I cannot teach you how to trade. I can give you advice, but you're going to have to figure this out yourself. So, and then I just kind of learned by doing, basically, and by making mistakes. And I think that the only advice they gave me was just make sure that you can come back here tomorrow, right? Which was a little bit their leitmotiv. Just make sure that you survive, and then eventually good things will happen to you if you stay in the game long enough. And so, I couldn't stay in the game as long as I wished, because then the CME decided to shut down the trading floors in July of 2015. So basically that was the end for us local traders. We traded for a while upstairs, the Seaboat, but we weren't really successful, if you can say so, when we were on the floor. So at that time, then I made the decision to, also for some private reasons, to move back to Europe, to Italy. And then that's when I got involved with the beautiful dairy industry. At that time in Milan, for a small trader broker in the physical market, they wanted to build up their futures trading and advisory segment, so to say. And so I did that for a little over 2 years. And then at that time, I was contacted by Fries and Campina that they would also like to be interested to go in deeper in futures and financial markets and hedging. And then that's how I, long story short, ended up here.
That's a beautiful story.
Yeah.
What I wrote down here as well is like, you had to teach yourself how to trade, right? And you pass by it very quickly. But I think this is what a lot of young people were like, but how do you teach yourself to trade, right? Normally, I can imagine that in companies like, where Martijn is from Cargill, or when I was at Intfood, you get education, you sit alongside more senior guys and ladies, you're handheld basically. So how did you do that? What did you do? You woke up, you walked in there and on the floor and you with your jacket on, you go like, well, no, let's buy something or sell something.
It's not like that. So I probably already when I was younger, I tried to read a lot around trading, and also already before I went to the trading floor, when I was at Goldman or during university, since I already knew this is kind of what I wanted to do, I already started reading all the market reports I could get, everything that I just could find about trading, and from fundamental to technical, I just try to go through everything. And then I think you build that in your back of your head. But then I think once you start trading, then the things are a little bit different, because one thing is the theory, but then in practice, it becomes more, how, as a person, what is your trading style, basically? Because what fits you? Because, for example, I had two locals who helped me on the trading floor, who kind of backed me, so to say, from a financial perspective. And they had two completely different trading styles, right? One guy was a frontman spread trader who traded huge size, thousands and thousands of lots on a daily basis, right? And the other guy that I knew, the guy who I met during university, he was more of a analytical back month spread trader who would look at correlations, co-integrations, how do the spreads move? What should the spread be priced at based on the stocks to use ratio that we have this year compared to other years? So he was much more analytical. I remember when I had to keep his trading book, he had positions starting from, the third month down to the last month, right? Long, short, long, short, long, long, short, short. And it was amazing. He had this little card that he would keep in the pit, and he would just like with a pencil keep his positions like that and in the same time trade, right? So it was really analytical guy. And the other guy would just be there and he would take huge positions and kind of move the spread around himself and try to make money that way. And then I think I could not have learned one or the other. You kind of have to find your own. And I think I steered more towards the Beckman's spreading, basically, because I like to think that I have more of an analytical mind, and I like to understand, what are the relationships of the spreads? Yeah. How do these spreads should move, and why is one spread price this and the other way? Does that make sense? Should I put that on or not? And then I just went that direction, which probably is a little bit a less sexy way of trading, more than the other guy who, would take 1,000 lots, So, it's different ways of trading.
I think you touched base on a critical element that I've written a lot about, which is important for young people who think about entering the commodity industry. They often ask the simple question, okay, what is required? Do I break into this industry? But they forget to ask themselves whether they really want to, based on the right drivers. And what you describe is that you had a natural interest. No one told you to do these analyses and to watch the financial news. It was something that you were genuinely interested in. And that is what I constantly say to people. Look, what are you doing in the morning? What news sites are you opening? What books have you read? What books have you read that I recommended? And if it's none, well, don't tell me this is your destiny. So the natural interest that you described is a very important driver. And then it's also critical what you said. You need to find out what is your style.
My first interest was probably also struck by the wrong reasons. I think I first got interested in markets, and then it was more equities markets. I remember my parents, they had a small portfolio with a financial advisor. Hmm. And I was, I think, 13 at the time. I think it was during the dot-com bubble. And this guy would show up every quarter with a new car, right? And I would, okay, this is interesting. I know you're young, this is a successful guy. What does he do? And then I remember throughout the dot-com bubble, you know, a lot of people lost a lot of money, but the guy was still driving around in the same nice car. And so I started getting interested, like, what is behind here? And then I started, you know, started reading up financial advisors, more investors. And I think I remember one of my first books I read was from Peter Lynch, One Up on Wall Street.
Fantastic.
Great book. And then later on, yeah, I started reading books from Warren Buffett and Graham. You know, you get into this stuff and then as soon as I realized, okay, yeah, equities, really, that's more of an investment vehicle more than a trading vehicle. I think I soon realized, yeah, this is something that you should just buy and hold it, because for the sake of what it is, in the end, it's ownership, right? When I was in university, I started on the side, I started trading currencies. And that I got interested in, because obviously being from Europe, going to the US, exchanging the money, I was like, okay, how does this really work? Like, why is one day one rate and why the other rate? So And back then you could open up this Forex account where they would give you huge leverage. I mean, 400 to one, 800 to one, right? And then for a guy who had not much money, you know, you put in like 300-400 euros at the time and you could trade. And then I really got into at that time in technical analysis. I felt like, okay, currencies seem to move quite a bit with support resistance, Fibonacci retracements, moving average. And then I just kind of tried to read everything I could read on technical analysis. And I think it was different stages, different interests, but always around markets, basically. Yeah.
Also that you know, get the chance. Eh? So that's, I think, what I see with a lot of people, that somehow they got the chance from somebody, from someone who believed in them or saw something in them. And then, of course, what it's one thing to get an opportunity, but also to grab the opportunity like you did and others did as well in the world of commodities. I think then that's the next step, of course. I think that's really amazing that there are people in this industry that want to give these opportunities to other people. I think that's also reasons why people are in this podcast, because they want to give opportunities what they have encountered to other people. If you look at where you were, you know, on the pit in the CME, and now in the dairy risk side, what's the big difference there? If you look at that for people that like hardcore corn or like a soft commodity like dairy, what are the big differences for you that you encountered?
Yeah, obviously they're quite different things, but I think it doesn't matter if you are trading corn and the pits, or if you're trading dairy in Europe or wherever. I think it always comes down to risk management, I like to say. Even if a trader, I think, okay, a trader first needs to be a great risk manager. They also say that in the pit, everybody can make money. Not everybody, but if you give them enough chances and they fund your account often enough, you will end up making money. Unless you are. but I think the hard part is to hold on to that money and to, as the guys who brought me on would say, that's to make sure that you can come in here again tomorrow, right? That the clearinghouse will not tell you, hey, give me your trading jacket and your badge back, because there's nothing in your account and we're not going to let you trade. And I think now also, if I'm involved in the risk management side, I mean, that's in the end what risk management is. I make sure that your company that does not take decisions or does do trades that can, you know, and then it will take a lot to take you out of business. But still, that, you know, you should always have that kind of motive, I think, in the back of your head. If you're trading, it's the most important thing that I have is my capital, and I should make sure that, yeah, I can do this for the rest of my life, because eventually I will be in a situation where I can make a lot of money, right? Because I will catch a move right. I will be able to ride it out as long as I give myself enough chances to do that.
If I go back a little bit first to Goldman, because when you started, and I want to make a parallel with my own start, because I applied for a job at ABN AMRO and Cargill. Now, ABN AMRO, you cannot compare it to Goldman, but it's a bank. And after applying to both, I was really excited by Cargill, because I ended up on the trading floor. And I thought about, you know, the movies that I saw, and I recognized it. And I thought, hey, something physical is more interesting than trading paper. Although I wasn't going to be hired as a trader by ABN AMRO at the beginning, right?
Same now, for me, yeah.
You managed to land a job at Goldman. You said, indeed, they get hundreds of thousands of applications and they can hire only a very small amount. And yesterday I read a post which was from Balyasny Capital, a well-known hedge fund, and they also receive more than 100,000 of applications and they have only like 100 spots. Now, so you got in at Goldman, but you only stayed for 2 years.
Less. Yeah, I have.
So for the audience, I think it's important that you explain, okay, dream come true, Goldman, but you leave. And what is the difference between how you perceived working at the bank and then, you know, working in with commodities? Huh? So as a trader in the pit, and then later on, young, talented people who maybe now are considering, do I apply at one of the the hedge funds, financial markets, one of the investment banks, versus moving into the physical commodity business? How do you, and you have experienced that? Can you share your audience about that?
Yeah. So I have to say, so my job at Goldman was also not a trader, so it was also more of a middle office, back office job, I would almost say, because I think if you want to land a job as a trader or at Goldman, you probably need to come from one of the Ivy League schools to really have a chance. Otherwise, you need to work your way up, start in a middle office function, and then after a couple of years, moving up. So I also always kind of wanted to be a trader and to do that. I remember when I was during university, since I already knew the guy, I went out to visit them on the board at the Seaboat, and I could walk on them with the floor. I remember the first time that I entered, and you know, you can enter from the old Merck site, and there's this escalator who goes up, and you go up in this escalator, and you come out of this escalator, and you see this three-story high room, numbers everywhere, everybody running, everybody shouting, and then you say, yeah, this is amazing. That was my first reaction.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, this would be something really cool that I want to do. And then why I decided not to do it right out of university was, yeah, a little bit to do with because it was Goldman, a little bit to do also because already then in 2012, we knew that eventually floor trading would come to an end, right? It was a matter of time. Nobody expected it to be that quick because it really escalated quickly. I mean, if you think the CME introduced side-by-side trading in 2006, right? Hmm. Only 6 years later, they took away, in 2012, they took away the settlements from the pit. And only 3 years later, they shut them completely down. So it was actually the transition from floor trading to electronic trading was extremely fast, right? And nobody expected that, even the guys who were down there. So, but they knew, right? So they were like, okay, you're probably not going to be able to have, you know, he was telling me, you're probably not going to be able to have a career like mine to be here 20 years and do this for 20 years. So there will be an expiry date on this career that you have. So, you know, I was also thinking, okay, maybe it's good for my personal development to also have that corporate experience then. Mm. So, yeah.
So the book Reminiscence of a Stock Operator, reading that reminded me a lot of, hey, this is what it must have been on the pits.
Let's hope we don't end up like him.
Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly. But so I've been on the CBOT when it was still open outcry, but also the New York Board of Trade. Yeah. It was overwhelming. And the amount of the noise, and it feels like out of control. But can you share with us a bit, you know, how you made sense out of it? And also what I want to know, if I refer to the book, I got the impression that it, a lot was like looking at each other and kind of front running, and that you more or less knew from each other what, and when you know your colleague in the pit day in day out, you know, you can look at them, whether they are in good shape or bad shape and what they have behind them.
Mm-hmm.
So can you share a bit on, you know, how you managed to survive and what your tactic was? That's the first question. And the second one, a lot of the people that I knew who were pit traders, they did not survive after also New York Board of Trade closed the open outcry. You did survive. You're still trading today. What? Why did it go well with you?
I think that might also then be a positive side of my experience at Goldman, is that I learned also that corporate side of the professional career, right? I think if you would be raw and go from university, then you might learn something in university, but straight on the trading floor, and you do that for, I don't know, for 10 years, and then after 10 years, they put you in a meeting room, then chances are high that they will ask you politely to get out of the meeting room because they don't like your style of communication or the style to give your message, right? Because, yeah, it takes a certain, I would say it doesn't take a certain style, but the floor will form you in a certain way that maybe it's not really fit for the corporate environment that we have, especially for those people who were on the floor when it was just floor trading, right? So another adventure I had, it was side-by-side trading. So we also traded, I think 90% of the trades were done electronic and 10% only in the pit. So you learned also how to trade on a screen, so that then is easier if you go to an office to trade, because then basically it's the same. So, yes, I think that helped me to transition. But yeah, I realized that I also think a lot of the people that I knew who were down on the floor for a very long time, a lot of them, they didn't have the transition. Let's be quite honest. Also, the guys who were down there long enough and who were seat members of the CBOT when the CBOT was bought by the CME, because the CBOT was a members board of trade, right? So all the guys on the floor, they had a seat, but they were members basically, besides the ones who were leasing a seat. And then when they got paid out during the merger, yeah, they probably did not need to work. So maybe they were not even forced to transition, but yeah.
And then on now, so you went to the world of dairy. Tell us a bit about how the world of dairy trading works.
It's a very interesting marketplace, I would say, yeah, because I think, Anton, you probably know it better than I do, but it's a very, I like to think as a very fragmented market. You have a lot of different players. I think I remember reading a while back that I think 20% of the producers only own 20% of the milk, of the global milk, right? Which is, if you look at other industries, yeah, that's mind-boggling. Yeah? And then if you also look at how many small regional players that there are everywhere around, then yeah, you already see that it's not like other markets, which are very commoditized. You have so many short supply chains that move just intra-regionally the product, where the products that we trade or we talk about, they make up such a small chunk of the global milk production. Like if we talk about whole milk powder, skim milk powder, butter, 25 kg blocks. That's such a small part of this enormous universe, which is the dairy industry. So I think that makes it already quite difficult also to analyze, right? Because it's on one end a very thin market, because I think only 8 or 9% of the global production gets cross-currency exported, so to say, right? So, and in the end, that's probably what makes the price, right? So given that, any small disbalance in supply and demand in one region can cause quite a bit of turbulence. price turbulence,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We see it, and then we have this exporting regions, which is New Zealand, Europe, US. Then obviously at there, because the prices are then set on this global market, so although the majority of the milk is traded locally, domestically, right? Even if you look at, I think around 40% of the global milk production is traded in informal ways still, right? So basically just farmer to neighbor, because look in India, that's where all the milk goes, right? So you have this huge, huge industry, but a very small part of the whole production is traded, right? Not like you have in corn or in soybeans, or I think also in cocoa, probably it's the same, right? Where almost everything gets traded, I would assume, right?
Yeah.
So That makes it quite fascinating and also very difficult to analyze and to make a supply and demand balance, make a balance sheet.
We talk often about the S&Ds, right, of the different commodities, or how they do it and how do you use and how do you build it? And is it for you an important instrument or not? How do you look at it?
Yeah, I think in the end, all the markets are driven fundamentally in the end, or they eventually will end up where they fundamentally should be. So I think it's very important to look also in the area at S&D. And I think that's also what we do quite extensively. I don't want to go into much detail exactly how we do it, but...
But it's for you a tool that you use as well.
Yeah, but I would say almost one of the main tools.
Yeah. You are a risk manager. You were just already saying a bit about and talking about that. And what makes that so interesting versus, you know, physical trading, what you did as well? Yeah. So it's the risk management, of course, it's so much related to it, but also it's a separate job to the physical traders that you have that work with you. What's the cool part about it? What makes it so interesting?
I think for me, it's interesting because my role is a little bit both risk management, but then also so it's called the hedge trader, basically. So I also do all the transactions that we do to mitigate risk, or even some of the transactions are even aimed to steer our risk position. So I think that to me makes me still involved day in, day out with the markets, which is something what I like to analyze on markets, try to understand the markets. I think I also developed quite this now over the last few years a little bit or developed interest in the whole risk concept. What is risk? What is randomness? What is casuality, so to say? And then I really started in the past years, I started into get into to Talib and his Incerto series and books, which I found really interesting, and which also is a little bit mindset what that I try to have when I'm a risk manager, which I think most people have a hard time to think that way, because people tend always to just thinking in a normal sort of distribution kind of way of what can happen. And I think to really have that kind of out of the normal event stress test scenarios, I think it's quite interesting.
It's an interesting concept, huh? Randomness.
Yeah.
This morning I watched this very tiny clip of a podcast of Nicolai Tangen, who is the head of the Norwegian wealth fund, one of the biggest funds in the world, and he was interviewing Howard Marks, who is a fantastic asset manager as well, and they were talking about randomness, and what he said, what I found very interesting, he said, look, a lot of good decisions, meaning well thought of, well analyzed, turned out to be wrong, and there's plenty bad decisions that turn out to be right simply by randomness. And when I said that, I thought about myself trading, when I had several instances where I did all my homework with the team and I was convinced, and you put on the trade and this fucking market goes the opposite. And you think, so you know, it's quite frustrating, right? And often it feels like, okay, but why don't I simply do like the inverse Jim Cramer, right? You just do the opposite. You do all your analysis, and you know what? I'm going to do the exact opposite.
The opposite, And then there are things where risk management becomes so important for a trader, right? Because I think having the idea, right, is the easy part, I would say. But then the execution and managing idea is the difficult part, right? Because everybody can make an analysis and come up with a trade idea, and okay, somebody could argue against it and somebody could argue for it, but nobody is 100% sure who is right, because I mean, as a trader, you take decisions with a certain degree of uncertainty because you don't have all the information, right? So even you could argue one is right and one is not, but you don't know, right? So that's, I think, then why risk management is so important as a trader, because what you do after you took the decision, right? And I think there it comes to, okay, at least that was my experience seeing on the trading floor, which distinguished between the successful traders and not the successful traders, right? That successful traders have very clear risk management procedures in place that they say, okay, this is the pain I'm willing to take, or this, you know, and then you can have all sorts of way of determining, okay, what's your pain threshold, percentage of your portfolio, or you can, whatever. I think there are different ways you can do it. But I think if you want to be a successful trader, you need to be willing to do that.
Yeah. Now we did a podcast with Tom Kopczynski. He was running Blenheim Capital Management, and it's gonna go live this Friday. I listened to it again this morning, and something I forgot from the podcast. He said when I asked what type of people do you hire, and he said we hired a lot of athletes, and for two reasons: they know how to come back from adversity, and they're highly competitive. And I thought about you, obviously, because I thought, hey, we have Mark in the afternoon, and he has been skiing at the very high level. Now, I didn't know you ended up in a coma, but for 2 days. But have there been moments in your trading career where you felt like an athlete, and where you felt like, yeah, okay, this the stuff that I learned from skiing very competitively and the things that you have endured, I can trust myself, I have discipline, I'm very competitive, and I can come back from this setback. So has that helped?
Yeah, yes, for sure. I think in general, for, and then it you don't have to play sports at a super high level, but I think just to be in sport, I think, teaches you great lessons also, not just for trading, but for life. It teaches you how to be disciplined, I think, which is something very important for...
Very important.
Also for a trader, or for every job that you do, that teaches you it's important to show up every day, basically, which is also already important.
Half of the job, often.
Exactly, they say. And then I think maybe the most important thing that you learn in sports is because... the majority of sports you spend losing, let's be quite honest, right? At least in ski racing, there's only one winner. Mm. 150 people enter the race. Yeah, you're not...
The odds are against you.
Basically, so it teaches you at a very young age, okay, you need to learn to take the defeat, but to build on the defeat. Eh? Because I think it's important to learn that, yeah, defeat should not drag you down, but defeat should push you to try harder, basically. And I think it's same in trading, yeah. If you have a bad day, you should not say, ah, screw this, I don't want to do this more. I think it should bring you to understand, okay, why did I lose? What can I do better? What should I do differently? And I think those are all lessons that you can learn from sports. And I think it also probably helped me throughout my career.
But how do you then deal with the randomness, right? To coming back to that, because then, of course, you have the defeats in the trading. And the defeats can come even though you had, Martijn, you did a fantastic analysis. Mark, you did one. I did one. We all did one. And then the team did, you had the discussion with everybody because you do things together. And then something else happens. You're like, oh, we didn't expect that, and you have that, right? So how do you cope with that? Because that's a mentality question. That's personality. And that's where I think, the sports helps tremendously. So I understand why Tom, but it's not everybody's built like that, right? And so what do you want to say?
Yeah, no. I also recall now a clip that I saw this week from Roger Federer. Did you see it?
No.
Well, it was some kind of inaugural thing he did at Stanford.
But he only won, Dartmouth, eh?
I think it was a commencement speech at Dartmouth that he did this week. Yeah, great.
That's good, yeah?
Yeah, amazing. But he only won, guys. That's a very good point.
He said he lost 60% of his points. No.
No, throughout of his career, he only won 54% of his points.
Yeah,
he's like, everybody thinks, okay, you're the most successful tennis player, you have won everything, and he said every match that I played I almost lost the same amount of points than I made. Right? And then he also there said the importance, okay, you play every point as it would be the most important point of your life when you're playing it, but then once you're done with it and once you have lost it or won it, you should forget about that as soon as possible and just think about the next one.
Yeah.
Right. And I think also coming back, also you say, okay, randomness. And I think it's a great comment. You say, okay, I think that's also then the goal that a trader has to have, to put yourself in place that the randomness plays in your favor. Okay. If I'm in the game long enough, right, then eventually the randomness will also play in my favor. And if I'm set up in a way that randomness hits me in a negative way, it doesn't take me out. But when randomness hits me in a positive way, I'm able to take advantage of it. yeah, then just make sure to be around long enough and you eventually will get that chance, yeah. Right? So, yeah.
What kind of randomness did you guys experience?
Well, I think for everyone at the time when COVID hit, yeah, that was something that, no one was prepared for.
Basically Black Swan events, right?
Well, but also elections in Ivory Coast.
You couldn't claim force majeure.
Well, the election wasn't random because it was announced, but the events. Look, in Holland, and we recently had elections in Holland, and we had the European elections 6th of June. There's no randomness. You have some difference versus the polls, but in commodity trading, the elections in Ivory Coast were the event that people were talking about like 6 months before and 6 months after. Because even when the elections were done, you didn't know whether they were going to be accepted or what it would lead to. So I think the randomness event is what I described as thinking the unthinkable and always being prepared mentally and having optionality. And then what you said, risk management, making sure that there is no random event which can wipe you out, and that enables you to...
But how do you do that? Right? So what you say sounds, you know, logical and easy, but how do you actually do it, right? Because it's like...
It has to do to think about liquidity almost. When you put on a position, the size that you have should be linked to, yes, your analysis, your conviction.
But also your book.
But also...
Portfolio. Yeah.
Can you get out?
Exactly.
Or not?
Is the market big enough to turn around?
Yes.
Liquidity big enough? High enough?
And in some markets, you know that liquidity can vanish overnight. And if you know that, then you adjust your position to that. Some positions you have in very illiquid physical markets... I have had...
Therefore, for example, with cocoa and dairy are two interesting ones because I think dairy is not that liquid on, it's improving, etc., depending on if you look at futures or fiscal. But there as well, you know, buyers are being consolidating as well. So you have, you know, less different companies turn around your position with. But also futures-wise, the exchanges are building, but it's not the highest liquidity yet. It's the same bit. It's also a bit like cocoa, where you also have a few. There you have, for example, a few players. You have an ice. You have. I think there are only a few real commodities that are real liquid, easy to get out, where you have basically the perfect game board. Right? There's always something that is
not always, because all the markets can become liquid, if you have the wrong position, because if something extraordinary would happen in a corn market, I don't know, some sort of disease. I can guarantee you that we will also have no liquidity in the corn market, because nobody will sell, or the other way around. Nobody will want to buy from you. Maybe on the commodities, you always have the risk, and fear is to the upside. So that's already a little bit of mindset that you need to have in case you have a position, because obviously that's also a big difference compared to equities, for example, where actually the risk is on the downside, right? So you have to know, okay, where is my liquidity risk, basically?
Hey, Mark, could you tell us about your current job? What does a day or a week look like in your job at Friesland?
My role is a little bit twofold. So on the risk management side and also the trading side. So basically on the risk side, on a weekly basis, we put together risk reports. That's something new that we started doing. So basically, we across the main commodities that we trade, we try to build a risk position report. On that risk position, we have VAR limits set up, basically that we need to respect, so to say. And then we have trade meetings once a week where we discuss then with all the traders within Friesland Campina. Okay, what is our market view? What direction would we like? Or what direction do we think the market will go in some sense? And then we discuss a lot of things during the trade meetings, market outlooks, commercial side, S&OP side. There's a lot of things that we discuss. And then we discuss the risk position, the desired risk position we would like to have. And then we spend the rest of the week basically trying to achieve that. And obviously with all the things that then obviously happen on a day-to-day basis, which always make up for new things that we need to do. So I think that's my day-to-day function, basically.
But
and then also, obviously,
So what commodities does it entail?
It's mainly the bulk commodities that we do within Friesland Campina Trading. So that's all the milk powders, whole milk powder, skim milk powder, buttermilk powder, fats from butter to butter 25 kgs to AMF, AMF drums, and the more commodity size of the cheeses, which is Gouda blocks, mozzarella blocks, cagliata, Emmental, and all those different products make up our risk position. Yeah.
And I saw on your LinkedIn profile that you have done a study about cheese futures.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
There was when I was working in Milan for the Linterform was the name of the company, which is a great small trading brokerage house, which had offices in Bolzano and Milan. Was born originally from the liquid milk trade between Germany and Italy, and then it expanded from there. Yeah, and there we were basically started to get involved in the dairy futures trading advisory and brokerage. And then obviously at that time we only had futures, or we still only have future for skim milk powder, butter and whey. There was also a liquid contract, but which never really took off. And then at that time I was saying, yeah, well, physically, we know that over 50% of the milk in Europe goes into cheese. So already that, and a lot of the cooperatives that we were working with in Germany, they only produced cheese basically. So already for them to hedge or to use the future that we had at the moment was quite challenging, because you still tend to have quite a big basis risk between skim milk powder, butter, and cheese. So yeah. That time I was working closely also with the University Bocconi in Milan, and I had the idea of writing this research paper, this white paper about, okay, how I would envision to do it. And then we published that paper, and I think quite a few people took interest in it. And
they are now there, yeah?
Yeah, indeed. So not exchange-traded futures, but we have OTC products on cheeses, yeah.
Why not on the exchange? I thought the guy called Peter Bloch that he was working on the introducing futures. Is that not the case? No?
Yeah, well, it first had to start with, okay, you need to get a good index, right? You need to get a reference price. So all of the financial derivatives in dairy are cash settled, so financially settled, which also for me was something quite new that I had to get used to it. Yeah. Yeah, coming from corn and playing with deliveries and so it was something new. So I think the first start was, okay, we need to build a good reference price, which I think they did a really good job, the EX so far in doing. And then obviously the logical progression was then having some banks or some financial providers launch first OTC products on those indexes. And I think if they will prove to be successful, that then I would assume that the EX then decides to list them also on their exchange.
Yeah.
A lot of the markets, the traditional agricultural commodity markets, but also energy and metals, they have been impacted by systematic trading strategies. They have had huge impacts. Some commodity hedge funds, they're no longer there simply because they were not able to adapt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and also some of the traditional commodity trade houses, processes, I've seen it myself as well, felt the need to better understand these systematic strategies, because there's often a huge amount of money behind them. There's often not people behind them who take the decisions, but the algorithms, and they can disrupt rather thin markets.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent is that happening in dairy, and to what extent are you and Friesland trying to understand these strategies or maybe even applying some of them themselves?
I think the per se algorithmic trading, so that the execution from algorithms of trades in dairy, I think is probably limited, I would say, or even probably non-existing, I think, just because you have the issue of the liquidity issue, I would say. I probably think that, I'm sure in the US there are some funds who run also on dairy. I think you also, with the whole class system that you have in the United States, I think you have the advantage is probably an algorithm is able to price it faster and better than a human is. Same for options. I think also there, I think probably you have it. I think as a pure kind of hedge trader, I think it affects you very limited. I mean, you need to know that they can be in dairy. They are not really there. But again, it comes then back to risk management, because I think, okay, what are these algorithmic or system traders doing, or what are they causing? They're probably causing the markets to go more to the extremes, I would think. So I think that needs to be adjusted a little bit, your risk reference. That I have the feeling markets tend to always overshoot now for longer than you would expect or think they can. So I think those are all the adjustments that you need to take. Yeah. I know, talking about machine trading, I remember when I was on the trading floor, and that I think was the main excuse that a trader would use if he had a bad trade. They were like, screw the machines. I got screwed over by the machines, which I didn't really buy into it that much. Because I think in the end, also the machine, if they trade, they also need to make money. So if they buy something, they will need to sell it. If they sell something, they need to buy it again. Taking the excuse, it's the machine's fault, has a certain value. And then I think we also need to differentiate, I like to say, between the good HFTs and the bad HFTs, because I think we have seen, there's a great book that Michael Lewis wrote, Flash Boys. I don't know if you guys had the chance to read it. I think it came out in 2014. And it was at the time where it was the whole algorithmic trading really took off. But obviously, a lot of those hedge funds also used the algorithmic trading to do bad things more efficiently, right? Like, I think I remember that time quite the practice of spoofing the markets was quite common. A lot of people were spoofing the markets. I think a few people also ended up going to jail because of that. And I think then obviously if you have a machine that does the spoofing, it's probably more efficient, right? Because they're going to be better, because you need to be quick if you want to spoof a market. So those are all things that, that's why I think it's really, or front running, for example, you have the issue that a lot of these hedge funds bought up core server location, where, for example, the CME had their servers for the exchanges. They would buy as close as possible a location for their server, because they would then see your order coming in, and by the time they could front run your order and then execute it before you, right? And then set it back to you at a different price. So I think those are bad practices. And I think, but then I think there are also hedge funds who, really smart people that code these programs to basically in the end mimic what you would try to do with your brain, but you're not able to do it as fast and as efficient, right? So I think that's something that will be there, and I think that's something will probably also makes the market more efficient. If you look at spreads or cross commodity trading, I think in that space, I think this hedge fund made the markets much more efficient, which I think is in the end beneficial for everybody that is in the market.
I think there is a misunderstanding in the market in general about the importance of CTAs, commodity trade advisors, the stuff that you see in the COT report. You have people who complain about, but they're driving up prices. They have been complaining for months in the cocoa market while it was very clear that speculators were actually selling, not buying. Yeah. And then there is no liquidity, and then, because the COT position shows them they have a very small position, and then people claim that there's no liquidity.
Could you say that hedge funds, because they don't actually use the product in an other product, right? Or they don't produce it, right? So they don't need to make sure it's the only one in there for the money. Is that basically what you could say? Or is
also the traders are, if I was a floor trader, I was not in it to take delivery of corn. I was just delivering. I was in it to make money. But in the process that you're trying to make money, you need to make a market. And so you will provide liquidity. Because if you're a trader, you are constantly trying to bridge the gap between the buyer and the seller. Maybe the buyer and the seller, they cannot find each other. But then you as a trader, you step in and you try to bridge that gap by taking on risk that either of the two sides are not willing to take. And now I think that has shifted. Since we moved away from the floor, that role is now more taken by algorithms, I would say. But
is a hedge fund different than a trader and a commodity trader?
Yeah, I think so. Because look, you have market makers who don't necessarily take proprietary positions. They are literally a liquidity provider. A hedge fund represents investors' money that they need to make a return on. So, and they have, the old system 2 and 20, right? They get 2%
upfront
and to manage the money, and 20% of the profit. But at the end of the day, yeah, they get the capital from investors and they need to deploy that. And you need to deploy that by taking risk-bearing positions. And that can be anything. It can be bonds, equities, and commodities.
But do they create liquidity?
Yeah.
But on the back end of more volatility, what is not producers overall, for example, in the world of dairy, producers and the buyers, they want less volatility overall. Yeah. Well, but then the traders prefer to have volatility because then they can basically...
To make it very simple... A seller wants to sell when the price is high and a buyer wants to buy when the price is low.
If I may add to that, a seller wants low volatility when prices are high and the buyer wants low volatility when prices are low because low volatility means that they stay low for a long time, right? Yeah. So then you will always need volatility. And I think volatility in a market is also a sign that the market is healthy, right? Because in the end, what is a market trying to do is just constantly trying to find the optimal price, right? Yeah. And you will also always need to go up and down in prices because you clearly need to give inputs and signals, produce less, produce more, buy less, buy more. And a market can only do that when it's volatile, right? If a market always stays the same, then you don't have that incentive.
No, but you have volatility, of course. What is always there due to currencies, due to weather, due to whatever, wars, diseases, all these kind of things. And you have, of course, volatility that is, let's say, artificially created due to long positions, short positions, due to create volatility, right? There's one that is, let's say, natural because of the world and we're in, and there's like unnatural volatility.
Yes, that's a very good point. And making the link to what you said about sometimes blaming the machines, I have... had several situations then that indeed I used that argument.
It's
the effing machines. And that I explained also to the exchange, look, I am not against volatility, but volatility which has nothing to do with the real market, I struggle with. Now, you can also argue whether that is a good argument or not, but I thought that too much money in a niche market by machines who can bring markets to extremes on upside and downside and also volatility can eventually scare the natural participants of the markets because they don't understand it anymore. When you don't understand it, you think, well, this is not a proper hedge anymore. Yeah. And that creates a self-fulfilling prophecy of lower liquidity. And that is at the end of the day the death of a futures market.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if the futures market doesn't function properly, that has an impact on the physical business. That has an impact on basically economic development because if people can't do far forward business,
they will stay close to home because they don't know what happens.
Exactly.
Producers will say, well, I'm not going to sell forward or buy forward because I don't know what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. So therefore, I've contacted often the exchange and I said, hey, look, this doesn't make any sense. And what you said about spoofing, and spoofing is suggesting genuine orders, buy or sell, which are not genuine because when the offer bid comes close, they are pulled. Now, and I have regularly made a small video with my iPhone at a settlement window to show the exchange, look, this is not real. This is only to steer the settlement price.
Yeah.
And that is the type of, you know, volatility, if you will, which by the book, by compliance rules, is not allowed. It's incompliant to steer the market with the sole purpose, like a squeeze, to move the price. Yeah. And that type of behavior can eventually destroy a market.
It's funny because we were doing we're on the floor, we're exactly doing the same. We're always constantly in discussion with the CME, and there you see it, and we were also trying to record it, and that's why I'm saying that those are bad algorithms or good algorithms. And then there is also comes out the server core location, because you also have an advantage if the closest you are to the server, the easier it is for you to have to spoof and because when you see that you, like, for example, in front month spreads, you would sometimes see a front month spread which is 10,000 tons up each side, and you say, oh, this is a very liquid contract, and you start trading the first couple hundred lots, and all of a sudden that 10,000 tons is down to 2,000 tons, right? Because you have these people who have algorithms that say, okay, show 2,000 as soon as you're filled 20, cancel the order because I only want to get filled 20, right? But given on how the system is set up, basically it's not just a first in, first out type of system. It's also depending on the size that you have, that how much you get filled, right? And these are all, if you're a spreader, it's very important for you, if you get filled on the bid and the offer, because sometimes, especially if you trade frontman spread, the spread just moves around a cent a day, or not even, right? If the market is well supplied, frontman spreads, they just stay at full carry forever. So then it's important that you are able to get to filled at the bid or at the offer, right? And so that's why then they apply these strategies in order to.
But somehow they also put up liquidity, right? So it's a bit of a.
Yeah, but if you put up liquidity, let's say liquidity, if 1,000 lot is there and I would want to trade 1,000 lot, but then as soon as I hit it, I only get 20, then it's fake. Was it real liquidity, right? Or if coming back to spoofing, you saw that often, they flash an order and then they probably trade, let's say you flash. An offer at 12 for 1,000 lot, and then you at the same time you sell a 1 lot at 11.5, and as soon as you spoof, the market moves down 0.5 cent because it's scared, and then you buy that 2 lot back at 11 because that's your trading strategy basically. Then okay, you created liquidity, yes, because you trade it, right? But is then that really liquidity that helped the market? I don't know.
I think we're heading towards
the end.
So one important question that we still need to ask, because we ask it every guest and young, especially young people that really want to know.
Who's going to win the European Championship?
Italy or
just fill out my scorita.
What advice do you give to young people who want to work in the commodity industry?
I don't know if I already can give advice. I still feel myself.
You're still pretty young.
No, but I think I have a genuine interest for the markets and for the products that you want to trade. The first spark might be for the wrong reasons, for money or for whatever you heard on or read on the newspaper. But I think you should develop a real interest for the market, how markets work. Spend some time reading on the markets. There are there are a few classic books out there that probably, you said, The Reminiscence of Stock Operator I liked, or also A Man for All Markets is one of my favorite ones that I ever read. So, and then if you see that you're still really genuinely interested, then trade and then just start, right? You're not going to, don't try to learn how to trade, just try to understand what you do, where you're in and what environment you're in. And then, everybody will find his own path of trading style. I don't think there are two similar traders. Every trader is different. Maybe now with algorithm trading, you have similar traders, but in the end, everyone has his own style and his own technique and way of trading.
Very nice. Well, I think it's really cool. Thank you very much for your time. And I think what is really nice is that even though you feel young and you are still young, Mark, it's...
I don't look young.
No. It's about that you actually have been in the pit, right? And I think that's always something I would love to have experienced in my life. I only saw it, of course, in movies and things like that. But that's a bit where it started. It's where
I have a claim of fame that I was second to last new guy in the trading pit.
Well, exactly. Well, how
and nobody
cool
can take away that from
that's
me.
Exactly. But I mean, that's so amazing to have that feeling, to have done that way of trading, right? I mean, that's something special. And then the steps that you've done, you've taught yourself trading on that ground, and now where you are in France. I think it's a great story, and it's curious to see where all the years ahead. Still, you have many years still to go in the world of commodities. So we'll keep on following you. Thank you very much for your time and sharing your knowledge, and it was fun having you.
Yeah, thank you guys. It's been a blast. Really nice talking with you. And again, thanks for inviting me. It's
and his LinkedIn avatar is his CBOT pit jacket.
And I was thinking, should I, because I still have it in my apartment.
Of course.
Yeah.
It's something special.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. That was great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks.